one of the other questions I do ask is, you know, have screens and tablets and mobile phones destroyed family life in the home? And I honestly believe they have. I know that there are benefits to it. The young brain is hugely impressionable, but also actually massively still developing. And I was saying to some students the other day that I know in myself, in the last 3 years, my ability to focus, even watch a movie, has deteriorated. And that's because I think in the last 3 years, I've done a bit more watching of YouTube videos and things like that.
Hey, how are you doing? You're laughing because you've been seeing me trying to get my eyes open a little bit, weren't you? I can see you giggling at me as we're waiting for the countdown. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I mean, I have not had the kind of day I imagine you've had. I've been actually at home today, which has been quite nice. I've been helping my mum out with just some admin. So we've started on the probate type thing that we need to do and moving some of the names. And I think it was a lot of stress for her. And, you know, you've got to deal with like technology and everything else. And I think me coming in just put a weight off her mind. She's like, oh, I've been trying to, you know, that's been stressing me out for a long time. So I've been quite good. And really it's been a bit of a slow day. We did a bit of exercise this morning together, which was really nice. Because I've got two rebounders now, because I've got the one from her house. Well, I've got three technically, one's in Brighton and two in London, and so we did stuff together today, which was really nice. So yeah, I understand you've been a busy boy today.
Busy boy. I mean, I'm slightly better state than last time, the last show. I was a little bit emotionally raw. Obviously we've been through that process now. Sadly, Buster is no longer with us. I'm feeling good, actually. There was a bit of relief, I think, towards the end. It was the right time. Even in the 24 hours since we recorded the last episode, he got worse. So I think that made it easier. The sun was out. We sat on a bench and, yeah, it was a lovely day, all things considered. It was nice that the sun, of all the days, because everyone's living in constant rain in the UK at the minute, right? We actually had a little bit of sunshine. So, you know what? It's good to spend the weekend with my dad. Obviously, he's still struggling with his cancer. So it's kind of a lot going on the family side and the emotional side and the travel side. But yeah, you know what? I'm good. I'm off to St. Albans next week to see the team. Then I'm off to back for the weekend, see my dad en route. And then the Monday I fly to Austin for an AI conference I'm really excited about. Fly back for a week. And then I get to go away again to Nicaragua with my wife. So loads of good stuff happening. It's just a bit frenetic, but all in a good way. And I'm in a much better mental state this week than maybe I was last time, which is good.
No, I mean, yeah, tough week. My colleague at work, he had exactly the same situation on the same day as you last week, and it was all very sudden, which I think it transpired. I spoke to him a couple of days afterwards, and he was like, it didn't need to happen that way. And I think the vet, I won't go into the whole story, but he had something like diabetes. They put him on, they told him to take this thing, then antibiotics, made him worse. Then out of nowhere, they're like, oh, now he needs to be put down. It's like, hang on a second, that didn't need to happen because of X, Y, Z. Like they didn't tell them to fast the dog as well before doing the test and like all these things, right? And so he's distraught with it.
My wife managed to go 24 hours yesterday for the first time without any tears. So, you know, we're coming through. It's good. It's getting, I mean, you absolutely hit the nail on the head with the last episode when you said, you know what, he's been by your side every, you know, you're with him probably 7, 8, 9 hours a day for 16 years. That's what hits home. It's the, you know, we got to certain routines and habits and certain things that have changed. We just got to readjust. But we had an amazing time with him, and we were talking offline. I think we're going to talk about it a bit today, but you know, it's been quite nostalgic. I've been looking at all the photos when we first got him as a puppy, watching, you know, him change as my children have changed. He obviously had the dog before the children, watching them grow up. And, you know, I've had a whole week of nostalgia, a whole week of using Time Hop, looking back at photos, and actually not just because of the dog, but reminiscing also on the times I've had with my dad. And I know that's something you were doing a lot of, obviously, since you lost your dad on Christmas Eve. So I think there's a lot of nostalgia going on, which actually could be quite energizing, I think, nostalgia, to look at the old things. They give you energy right down to the movies and the music of the time. So I'm in a good place.
It's similar. I mean, this afternoon, part of my admin that I was helping my mum out because I wanted to upgrade her MacBook, but it had no space. So I had to delete a lot of, well, not delete, but I've moved them to a hard drive. And she had loads and loads of video files, whether it's from WhatsApp videos or actually, what she also had, which was, I haven't really properly looked at it, but somehow, I think years ago, she digitalized cine cameras from the 1960s. And some of our young listeners won't know what a cine camera is, but it's a silent mobile phone video capture tool. Let's put it that way. That was popular back in the 60s. Not popular, but it was actually a luxury item, I think. And so there's a bunch of clips that I've never seen. And I was looking at a few of these things to make sure I might copy them across or delete them or whatever. So yeah, I was looking at that and some, actually saw a little bit of my dad's speech at my older sister's wedding. So I haven't actually seen this footage at all. I didn't know it even existed, but my sister did a speech. My younger sister did a speech. My dad did a speech, and obviously the best man and the groom. And I'm not seeing them. And so I was watching a bit of that. So it is interesting. I mean, I think what we thought we'd do today is like keep it a little bit more lighthearted. But one of the things that I think prompted the discussion that we maybe have today is one of the questions I normally ask some of the students as impromptu. So they have to answer these questions without thinking too much. And usually the question I ask, or one of the many questions I ask, is if you could time travel to any period in history, when would you time travel to? And I thought that that might be an interesting way to start it. And actually, you'll understand, or the listeners will understand, how it maybe links into the whole idea of this podcast, Mindful Past podcast, and well-being, once we answer it, or once we think about it. So I guess let's start with that question.
Well, you know what? I think the first year that comes to mind for me is 1990. And I'll tell you for why. I'm a massive football fan anyway. It was the 1990 World Cup. So we got to the semi-finals, got on top of Germany. I remember the gazetteers, the Gary Linekers of this world, and being really pulled into the excitement of my first World Cup tournament that I remember. I know I'd have been alive for others, but that was the first. I'd have been 9 years old when that happened. And I think also being a massive Spurs fan, and we don't win many trophies, if any football fans listen to this, the last time we really won a meaningful trophy was the following year in 1991. We won the FA Cup and Gazza scored an amazing goal in the semi-final against Arsenal. So I think that has a good year for me. I think it was a year where I was really, I don't remember having an awful lot that wasn't fun. I was playing football. I always loved school. I was going to football every weekend with my dad, funnily enough. So that obviously comes back to the fore. And think about the nostalgia piece. I won Manager's Player of the Year that year and in the under-10s. And I've got lots of photos of me with my golden Labrador dressed up in the night, with my full yellow Spurs kit and looking proud as punch with my first ever trophy. And I think when I look back at those photos, I just look really, really happy. I look very, very carefree. So I think, and I only know that I was looking at those because I was looking over the weekend with my kind of going back through the past of other things that we went through. So I think 1990 for me, I like the 90s anyway. I like 90s music, 90s movies. I don't know what year it was. My favorite movie of all time growing up was Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And that's got to be around the 90s.
That was slightly before that. And the reason I know that is because we had a watch party back when watch parties meant actually people were all physically in the same space. And that was for my, I was still at primary school because and I went to secondary school in 89. I think it was my birthday in 88. So I'd have been, I think it was turning 11. I think it was my 11th birthday party. So I think we watched it on video. So it must have come out around 87 or 88 or something.
Probably is about that. I mean, there were some wicked movies. I remember watching Willow for my friend's birthday party. But I think it was his, I think I 1990, I think, must have been around the time that Willow was also released. I remember going to a birthday party of a friend of mine. I think he turned 8 or 9. We watched Willow. Do you remember Willow?
I remember it, but I never wanted to watch it. It never appealed to me. And I still haven't watched it to this day. And I think they did a remake recently as well. And I was like, I really don't want to get any part of that for some reason. But it's interesting. I think you've answered that question. Have you answered that question as if you were time traveling and re-experiencing that period than as yourself? As opposed to, no, well, it's interesting just how you answer it. Firstly, you can answer it any which way you want. But I think there are different ways to answer it. And I think one way is maybe as you suggest, right? Going back and re-experience, but maybe that's re-experiencing it just for that year or for that month or whatever you've answered it. Another way to answer it is to go back and as you are and go to any time period, right? It could be the Great Pyramids, the dinosaurs, or I've always liked the idea of the 1950s, 1960s. In fact, last night we watched a movie which starts off in the 60s, I think it was, and an old movie from 1989 with Cybill Shepherd in it and Robert Downey Jr., where he dies and comes back reincarnated and tries to get back with his wife, but obviously he's reincarnated as a baby and then eventually remembers her. And anyway, but it starts off in the 60s, and I always like the idea of the 50s, the rock and roll era, the 60s movement, I think, and just a freer time. And one of the things, so that's one way to answer the question. And the other way to answer the question, which might be a bit more morbid, but would be if you were, and this maybe is a slightly different question, but if you were able to travel back and but you had to relive your life, and I read a book similar to this, it was quite interesting, from that age, right? Would you do it, and what, when would you do it to? Like, would you be 22 and go back from 22? Would you be 4? Would you be something else? But that might be, that's an interesting kind of question, because maybe that ends up dealing with ideas of regret as well, is what I've always thought about it. Because I often think, especially today, I was dealing with shares for my parents. I think, you know what, I'd have probably gone back to when I'd like to have been about 4 years old, 5 years old, and I could quite happily relive the last 42 years knowing what I know. But knowing what I know now, obviously, that would be the key. Because I'd be then telling my dad, right, buy all these Apple shares, even though they're not going to pay dividends for years, and they're going to be, they were like $2 a share in 1982 or whatever.
If you could change the question to what's the thing you would shift, i.e., if you could make a decision that had an impact on the world, that, you know, you, for example, you, I could say to you, right, you get the opportunity to get rid of the blueprints for the first mobile phone, for example, so that you go back to the current day, i.e. today, and there's no longer mobile phones, there's something else. You know, would you make that shift? I think that'd be quite interesting. The reason I say that is when I go back to the 1990s in my head, I was outdoors all the time making bases. That was kind of my thing, just making bases, outdoors, having fun with my friends, riding on my bike. Not having the distractions that we've got now that constantly, not just me, but pull my children away from what I think are way more fun activities. I think even they are more fun even for them. They just don't realize it because it's easier to be in your device. And you don't, you know, that fear of missing out. You don't want to not be on your device if your friends are. But I swear, if they lost their phone and you put them on a trampoline, you just get more natural fun and energy from that kind of thing. So I think that the 90s is something that I just loved. He-Man, I was into He-Man.
They're doing a remake of He-Man, you'll be pleased to know, for a movie. But this actually is interesting because a lot of the students that I ask, and they are 15 years old, so they've been brought up with mobile devices and social media, they do say the 80s and 90s. And it's quite funny because obviously that's my era when I grew up. And they say for exactly the same reasons that you've just given, which is where I guess I'm leading with this in terms of the idea of technology and mindful paths and everything, is that the reasons they give are for those same reasons where, you know, people seem to be connecting more. They weren't distracted on their phones. And I was talking to my mom, and so she's doing a lot of babysitting for my older sister who's got 3 kids. And it seems to me, and I don't think she listens to this show, but if she does, apologies, but it seems to me that as soon as they go into that house, they're on their devices. And my mom was saying they're in like 3 separate rooms, they're doing their own things. Whereas before, we used to watch, you know, we'd watch The Golden Girls because that's what my grand wanted to watch. And we'd watch this because we had one TV. And so even though you're still on a screen, you're still connected and watching things together. And of course, like you said, I'd be out in the park, I'd be doing things on my bike.
I think in our era, and I know you're slightly older than me, but we're talking about a couple of years, I think we had screens, right? I mean, I had a Commodore 64, I had an Amiga 500, Spectrum Z, all those kind of things. And we had television, 4 channels, then we got a 5th, which was amazing. But I think the beauty of that era over eras before, and obviously I'm biased because I lived through it, right? But, you know, if you talked about an era I'd go back to. So I would love to go back to like 1920s, I guess. The idea of going into those ballrooms and the dancing and the Great Gatsby. I think that's always kind of, that kind of era has always kind of fascinated me. But that aside for a moment, I think also there's elements of that type of time where you go, but in the evenings and at certain times, it must have been a little bit dull. You know, if you go and see your grandparents, for example, and there's nothing to do because you're that young and they're that old and, you know, you're just reading or whatever, especially if you're a single, you know, only child, that must have been quite difficult. I always remember going to my grandparents' house in Widdicombe in the Moor, which is in the, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Dartmoor. And although there was only four channels on the television, if my grandpa was watching the snooker, it gave me a chance to just for a second, chill out with my grandpa. And I thought that was quite nice, but you couldn't get, you know, it couldn't rule your life because you had to share the channels between the group. And there'll be certain shows which you all came together as a family and watched. That's why Saturday night, TV was so exciting, because it'd be a family show which brought us all back into the room to watch, I don't know, Gladiators, or, you know, I'm probably going back a bit now, but, you know, whatever it might have been. It's now there's so much choice that you just don't do it together. That family communal bit's gone.
It's totally gone. And I think this is, one of the other questions I do ask is, you know, have screens and tablets and mobile phones destroyed family life in the home? And I honestly believe they have. I know that there are benefits to it, but when I have conversations with younger people or interact or see that happening, where it's just normal now to go in and just be on your devices and not have that interaction. And I know you said, oh, you might have been bored back in the 50s or whenever, if you were, what did you do in the evening? But you're also comparing it to what you knew, which was like the TV in the evening. So we don't know what we don't know, right? So like in 15, 20 years time, there's going to be something else. And we'll be like, how did we live without this? Or were we not so super bored without it? And I think you would have found that you would have, you know, maybe read more, socialized more, played more board games. And also remember how Virgin Megastores all started back in those, when did he start Virgin Megastores? Was it in the 70s? And it was all about going to a record store and listening to music. And so people would put on music tracks, and that would be the thing of like watching the scrolling.
Like listening to what you're saying, I think what it used to do as well is it gave us, or as kids, you know, and in any era, apart from the era we're in now, it's probably the only era, I don't think this is necessarily as true as it was. So it gave you a single point of focus, because right now we live in a world of distraction and instant change. So if you're on YouTube, as soon as you start watching a video, you're given another one to watch, and you scroll without really taking it in. You're on the next one and the next one and the next one. And then you're taken, you know, you're constantly segued into different things. So we're constantly distracted. And I think it makes it really hard for people to have solid hobbies as kids now. Like Leo and even my kids, that they fluctuate between what they want to do, because they're constantly, there's the new thing that always coming out. And that obviously happened when we were kids, but not at the rate of change or the variety of things available now, that it makes it almost impossible to focus on just one thing. So using your example, you go into Virgin Megastore and you're there for music. You know, if you're into music, that's where you go. If you're into football or sport, you go and do that thing, or you go and ride your bike. You don't tend to do 10 things at once. Right now, you've got kids that are listening to music whilst playing on their phone, whilst scrolling videos on YouTube, whilst, you know, whatever. And it's just so much. It's like information overload. And you have so much choice, you end up with nothing.
Well, that's it. And the young brain is hugely impressionable, but also actually massively still developing. And I was saying to some students the other day that I know in myself, in the last 3 years, my ability to focus, even watch a movie, has deteriorated. And that's because I think in the last 3 years, I've done a bit more watching of YouTube videos and things like that. And that's me as a 40-something-year-old person who, A, is in this world and knows the detrimental effects of these things, but also, B, had 40 years of not having that distraction. And my brain and my attention has switched in the last 3 years. Now imagine if you're six and you've had that for 10 years and you're going into your GCSEs, or you're trying to revise for your GCSEs. I just don't think there's a hope for most of these people, because I know this stuff and I'm massively negatively affected. Not knowing this stuff, I'm being younger.
There's a saying, isn't there, that the hunter that chases two rabbits catches neither one. It's really hard just to be focused on the single thing that you do. And I think that's a bit of a shame. I just look back and I can very quickly and very easily list to you what I was into at different times And there was probably very rarely more than two or three things. And you're talking about someone who has more hobbies than most adults, right? And I really am someone who likes lots of different things. But as a kid, it was very simple. I love my bike. I love making bases. I love playing football. In terms of toys, I like Thundercats as a young kid. I liked He-Man as well. I love collecting football cards or stickers. I mean, that's pretty much it. Even if you were privileged enough to have a computer, which I did. I got a Commodore 64. You were still weren't overly spoiled by the games. I mean, there weren't that many games made for it. So you had like a choice of five games. You have Kickoff 2, or whatever it might be. And you just kind of played that. And I don't know. Now there's just so much choice that you... It's like going into an ice cream store with every possible flavor ever in the world. Which one do you pick? It's tough.
Yeah, I mean, it's too much choice. I can't remember. With the painting of the house recently, where colors have now got crazy amounts of choice for all these colors. And I'm like, I just got the decorator to choose a lot of the time for me, because it's this idea of paradox of choice. I think there's a TED talk, I believe it was, where it was talking about choice, and they had an experiment, and I think they gave participants the option to choose a painting, and they could, after a bit of time, maybe a few weeks, take it back if they didn't like it, and then choose another one. But then some of the participants were told that the choice that they've made is the choice they've got, and those that made the choice and had to stick with the choice were happier with their pictures, the ones they eventually, which is the one they originally chose, then the people that kept having the option of changing all the time, and then they kept wanting something different, and they were never happy with the option. And there's a few different interesting TED talks about choice, and it is this paradox of choice, right? I think we do want a certain level of choice, but not too much choice, right? The 52 flavors of Baskin and Robbins, right? It's too much, right? You want maybe three. I like 3 to 5 options, right? Anything more than that, which actually, when I changed my eating approach 15 years ago or 12, 13 years ago, whenever it was, actually, I found that really liberating. People were saying, oh, you don't feel like you go to a restaurant, you've got no choice. And I was like, actually, it's harder now, because now there's lots of these, well, not always, but vegan, gluten-free options available. Whereas before, it was like, okay, I could have that one thing. That was like one thing. And that's it.
Gordon Ramsay would do, right? If you ever watch, the Hell shows he does, the first thing he does is strip out the encyclopedic menus and replace them with something short and simple. It's easy to manage because people know what they're having. It's easy to choose. It's more cost efficient. You're helping the consumer as well, right? Because it's less choice and it allows you to drive them into certain decisions. I think there's something you mentioned earlier. I'd like to come back to a question for you, and just as an observation as to what you think people would do, because you said earlier, if you could go back and start at a certain time and end at a certain time, at a certain period. Now, presumably a lot of people listening to this would probably take themselves back to either before a crisis or a trauma, or they would omit a crisis or trauma from their memory to avoid it. Right. And I totally understand the reasons for doing that. I've got trauma in my life, which, it'd be hard not to take, that temptation to not have those things happen in my life if I had the opportunity to omit them. However, I think from a coaching perspective, and it's what I'd be interested to get your take, it's often those moments in our lives that cause us the most heartache or trauma, whatever it is, where we see the most growth. There's something called post-traumatic growth. And it's interesting when we look back at those moments, often they are the catalysts which allowed us to take a new path, and we call the show Mindful Paths, a new path in our lives that lead to greater things. We don't see it when we're living in the moment, because we're dealing with whatever's in front of us. And often, we look back though 5 years later and we've underestimated at the time how much we can achieve in that period. And I wonder, how many people do you think would proactively avoid those traumas? And as a result, would potentially be in a very different position, because they've also, in avoiding the trauma, they've avoided that opportunity for what I would call post-traumatic growth. What's your view on that? I'm just interested to know.
I mean, honestly, I don't know how many people would choose one thing or the other, but I think the challenges or obstacles we face in life are going to shape us to where we are now. And maybe the politically correct answer is like, well, everything that's happened to me brings me to this point now and who I am now, I would still change things. And I think a lot of people might be in the same boat. Now, whether that's because I don't want to relive the trauma, or maybe it's reliving that trauma, big T, little T, whatever the issue might be, with the knowledge that you get through it, or with the knowledge that it's there for growth purposes, or maybe just to avoid it entirely, that wouldn't be why I would go back. I mean, I honestly, I don't feel like I've experienced massive amounts of trauma that I would be looking to avoid. Obviously, there's been heartbreak and there's, you know, relationships and disappointments and things like that. But that, I don't know, there would still be all that even if I went back and changed. This is the other thing, right? When it comes to time, I think time will find a way to give you those lessons anyway, regardless. So I think looking to avoid them.
It was interesting because you brought it up in your question. But my initial reaction when you said go back wasn't to avoid a trauma in my life. It was to go back to a time I just felt the most, you know, I was really
happy. Yeah, and that's interesting. But I feel like, and you were talking about 1990s. And now I remember that year as well. I was at secondary school, great year. I don't think I had anything particularly massive going on that year from a mindset perspective. But I do remember when I was probably about the age you were during that period of time. So around 10 years old is when I first started writing in my journal. And I remember I was going through some emotional things there. And it was really weird. I had a really weird feeling one day, and I'd been playing sports at school. I was in primary school at the time, and just felt off, like something had taken me over in a way. Because I wrote it down, and I've got it in my journal just down there, actually. And I used to be like the second best player in the school at this game called stool ball. So it's a bit like basketball, but you had people standing on the stools and they had to catch the balls. And I was off that day. And then that's the first entry I remember writing in there. And then I wrote progressively more through my teenage years. And so this is also why I feel like I can relate to a lot of teenagers, because I've got the writings, and I had a lot of entries in that age bracket from about 14 to 17, tons and tons of entries. So then sporadically after that, and I'm still writing it now. I don't think I've written in it for a couple of years, but I write in it now and then. And so I feel like I really did have a lot of stuff going on in my head, because I am a thinker. I'm probably more of a thinker than you are, and you're more of a doer, I think, because, you know, you take action a lot quicker, and that's an entrepreneurial aspect that carries through. But I did think about things a lot. I remember from primary school, just almost like having the weight of the world on my shoulders and thinking, right, lots, which is why things like meditation have really helped me in the last 12 years, and a bunch of other things, yoga, breathing practices, all of these things. Doesn't mean I don't think so much now, but I have a very more, not disconnected, but observer effect when it comes to my thinking than before. But at the same time, I felt like I was very weird for having these thoughts and voices in the head and all this. And I say to my students, right, you've all got a voice in your head, right? Sometimes it's the one that says you can do it or you can't do it or whatever else it might be. That's not weird. You're not alone with that.
Do you think it made a difference if someone came back to you and visited you when you were younger and you had all those thoughts? Because I wasn't a massive thinker, I don't think. Not that I recall anyway. I was more of a doer. But if someone came back to you and said, look, Harry, and sat you down and said, you know, your thoughts control your feelings, but not your circumstances. Or, you know, if you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel.
I'll tell you what I think I would have really wanted. And this is, again, why I do some of the mentoring work that I do. And actually, that's probably the sole reason I do the mentoring work of teenagers, is because I really wish I'd had that mentor. And again, I think this is why I was always drawn to, and I still am drawn to, like that Karate Kid movies and the Cobra Kai series, which I absolutely love. And I think one of the reasons I love it, and why I think one of the reasons why it's popular with people, is because they have this, they build this community of people, but there's that mentor-mentee relationship that, you know, obviously I had a father figure going up, but I remember my dad never taught me to shave, and I was never really, I kind of was a bit independent. So I never wanted him coming to the football matches so much, although he came to like one or two You know, I don't remember him teaching me to shave, or he might have tried to once, but I kind of did my own thing with it, and I never followed the way that he did it. And so I don't know if that's because, like, father-son relationship, you just don't sometimes listen to your dad as much. But I always felt like having, like, a mentor would have been, and I probably had mentors without realizing they were mentors, but, like, maybe having a Mr. Miyagi in my life, right? Having that kind of mentor that was teaching me the things that I really wanted to know.
It's nice that you're giving back, for sure. I think, interestingly, the 90s, which is definitely the year I'll go back to, Gangster's Paradise, the Oasis, Blur, Battle, Nirvana, all the, I mean, a lot of music things had a big influence on me. I mean, very embarrassingly, I have to admit that I mean, looking back, it's a horrendous thing to have, but it was cool. I thought it was cool at the time. I remember the Nirvana Smiley that went out, and I think I had Kurt Cobain's, well, I didn't think, I definitely did. I had his suicide note on the back of the t-shirt and would wear that to school thinking it was the coolest thing. And you look back and go, that just, you know, different times. There's no real excuse for it. I obviously thought it was cool in the moment. But I do think that, interestingly, although I'd go back to the 90s, it was 1998, 99, when I think I talked on the show before about, you mentioned Small T, Big T Trauma, which brought it up, which is when me and my two best friends got absolutely beaten to a pulp, completely unprovoked, and it took it to court and had a massive impact on my life because I became quite defensive on the back of it. And for me, I decided to grow through it rather than just go through it, which I think my two best friends didn't grow through it. They hid, in my opinion. They one of them, as you know, went away to Nepal and had panic attacks and kind of almost relocated. The other got heavily into Class A drugs and sort of hid from it that way. I think for me, I grew through that experience. I confronted it and it changed me, maybe not for the better in the first moment, but definitely for the better long term. And although that's a small or big T, whatever people want to put it, it was a serious event at the moment. I wouldn't change going back to the 90s because that happened, and I wouldn't necessarily, I would take that issue away from my two friends. But I think for my lived experience of it, I think I've grown from that happening. My view on, you know, I'm very much a pacifist anyway, but I don't know. I think even the negative bits were quite positive for me. I was just trying to go back to whether I would avoid the traumas or not.
I actually had a similar situation, I think, with my brother-in-law, and he and I got into a fight with these guys in Bournemouth back in 2002. And one of the things I would definitely do would go back and change that situation, because it's resulted in him having spinal issues now because of the brain aneurysm that he suffered. And now, I mean, it got really bad this week, and he's been in bed all day. Actually, I was gonna, all week, and I've been going to ask you, actually, are you familiar with PEMF mats? Pulsed electromagnetic frequency mats. So this is another kind of gadget that I think my sister's going to actually buy, and it's quite pricey, but I don't think, hopefully he's not going to listen to this show, because she's like, oh, they don't have the money for it, but I think she's desperate. And it's a combination of infrared light, red light therapy, some sort of crystal thing, which sounds a bit weird, but then the main thing is pulsed electromagnetic frequencies. So it sends different vibrations through the body. You lie on it, and it can stimulate mitochondrial energy production, reduce inflammation, a bunch of things. And I've been looking into these for about 3 or 4 years, and everyone I know who's personally got one does like it. They're not using it for the kind of trauma that he's got in his body, and he's got an incurable spinal issue called arachnoiditis or something. Basically a webbing of the spinal tissue, which means he can't send signals to his legs so much. So he's progressively got worse over the last 10 years in trying to walk. And so someone seems to have cured themselves from that using that and a combination of other therapies, although I don't think it was nearly as bad. But most people, apparently, you can't cure yourself from it. But they do, those people I know who have got one of these mats really find a benefit, like whether it's improved sleep, HRV increase, all sorts of things. And I was chatting to a friend of mine recently, and she just got one, and she's like, oh yeah, my shoulder injuries got better. And I'm thinking, look, you know what? It might just be worth a punt. I mean, I go back to that Nikola Tesla quote, right? If you want to understand the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. And I am a big believer that vibrational energy, light, frequency medicine is going to be the medicine of the future. Whether it's 50 years time or 100 years time, it will be the future as people discover more about it. And so I think it's worth a punt, but I guess going back to the thing is I would go back to that point and I thought about this a lot. I think about time a lot. And I think, and this is one of the things I don't think I've shared with you, but actually it's one of the reasons I did physics with astrophysics at university. And I kid you not, one of the reasons I wanted to do astrophysics and physics, well, one was to be an astronaut, but another one was because I did want to build a time machine. And the reason I wanted to build a time machine at the time, so I was 18, was because I wanted to go back and not regret some of the things that had happened or not happened in that time. And so I think I am someone that definitely looks and thinks a lot about the past, too much so, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely where we're different, for sure. I definitely tend to look forward more. I mean, coaching is forward, future focused anyway.
I look forward as well now, but I think my natural tendency tends to be a brooder, a thinker, a reflector, an analyzer. And I used to hate all that. And I've come to embrace that because understanding yourself, like know thyself, as Socrates said, is part of it. And so by knowing myself in lots of different ways, whether it's dietary, I know that if I eat this, it's going to do this, or if I think like this, it's going to do this, or if I don't exercise or do my meditation, then my day's going to go in a different way. So I'm so much better with it now than maybe before. In terms of that.
One of the tricky things is when we look back, as you say, you need to go back as to who we are now, because who the people we are now is not the people we were then, which is why we often made the decisions that we took in the moment. We think when we go back, you know, you're going back with all the knowledge of the person you are now, but our identities change. We evolve, right? We change the way that we view the world. And, you know, it's like when we change the way we look at things, the things we look at change. And I think it's like people going through a divorce or a difficult moment. And when they're living in it, they look at that partner or that person that they, or individual thing, with disdain and all these things for different reasons because they're living in it. And then they find another partner later on and look back on it. And the way they look back at that incident later on is with totally different eyes to the one they were looking at it and in the moment. Look back and actually maybe that was a good thing, because now we've done this, we've had, you know, we've been here, I've met this person or whatever. Obviously, doesn't happen for everybody. But I do like the idea that, you know, that when we, if we do change the way we look at things, they do change. But I think it's difficult, because if we were to go back, and if I was to go back, I mean, the person I was as a kid would have been this uber confident, didn't believe trauma was ever going to come into my life, really, because you feel indestructible as a kid. And then lo and behold, even within the 90s, that was kind of the rug pulled, you know, from beneath my feet, because I felt indestructible. And then suddenly me and my two best friends were very much destructible and were beaten very badly. And you think, you know, that pulled the rug from beneath my feet. And yet actually, looking back, I grew from the experience and it changed the way I looked at the world. And I didn't know it at the time, because I was in a space of fear for a fair while after that, and as were my two friends. I don't know. I like looking back. I think also the reason I'm different to you is my memory is dreadful, absolutely dreadful. I don't remember an awful lot of things. I remember certain, we've had this conversation before. Your memory is brilliant, mine isn't.
Yeah, I have, and now I'm wondering whether that is like, yeah, some of it is just genetic and it's there, but I wonder if some of it is because I've reflected so much and that's why I remember, and I've written a fair bit and I remember, and I've often thought whether it's, although interestingly enough, my memory before the age of 10, I don't really have a huge amount of memories like before 10. Like I could almost tell you what I was doing to the hour on a day from the age of 10 onwards almost. But before that, I don't have that kind of level of detail or granularity. A little bit, like there's certain things, but not really much.
I think I may have told you on the show, did I tell you the error I made with my wife when she bought me a gift to go and see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in London? I may have discussed it before. Apologies if I have.
Don't remember that show being meant.
We're with a group of friends. It's embarrassing. And my wife listens to this, so she'll know where I'm going with it. We're with a group of friends, and we were talking about when we used to live in London, the things that we wish we'd done. You know, you mentioned regret a minute ago. I'm not a big believer in regrets, but I said, okay, no, there's something I wish I'd done. So growing up, going back to the 90s, well, I loved, assuming this was 90s, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves with Kevin Costner. Brilliant movie. I'm pretty sure that was a 90s movie. And in that movie was Christian Slater, who was Kevin Costner's brother, if I recall. And he was also in like the kid, the I can't remember what the movies are, the Western Western movies, Young Guns, that's right. I was thinking, so I really, really loved him as an actor. And for pure nostalgia, we're talking about today, I was like, he came to London and he played the starring role in the stage version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, one of my favorite plays. And one of my regrets in London was that when he was in the West End, I didn't go and see my favorite play with my favorite actor. And yeah, that was a travesty. At which point my wife turned around and went, "You did see it." "Oh, no, I didn't." She went, "I took you for our anniversary. We saw it." And when she mentioned it, you know, when you just suddenly get this kind of vague memory, and it was like my two friends didn't know what to say. It was horrific. And I feel that kind of heat start to surface. You go, "I've really dropped a clanger." And you know my wife anyway. And I went, "Oh," and I said, "Yeah, no, maybe I do remember going." So I've just regaled, you know, given this big story about my biggest regret in London. It turned out I actually went. And there's no excuse because, you know, this would only be about 10 years ago. So, yeah, that was a little bit embarrassing.
That's funny. It's probably a bit worse than the thing I'm about to share, but it reminds me because my mum, who also listens to this show, the one thing, because we're talking about I've got a good memory and everything, but for the life of me, I cannot remember going to see The Lion King. She always says that I went to see The Lion King with her and some of her friends in London, and this was maybe like 5 years ago, and I've got a complete and utter blank in my head to that entire experience. The names don't ring a bell for the people that we went with, the theatre, nothing rings a bell. And I'm still not convinced I went and saw it, but she says I did.
Well, I proposed to my wife after seeing The Lion King, so it's got special resonance for me. That's one I do remember. I mean, that would have been worse. If I'd forgotten that one on the night I proposed to my wife, I think that would have been worse. Fortunately, I do remember going to see The Lion King in London, followed by a proposal, which she thankfully said yes. That's an amazing show to not remember, if I'm honest. That's a really, really fantastic musical.
It's a bit weird, but I put it down to actually a good thing, because like I said, I think before I remember so much. Like even the first year that I was traveling, I could tell you every single day what I was doing and where without having written it down. But I think that was because it was quite punctuated, because I knew I was like 4 days there and 3 days there. But when I forgot this thing about The Lion King, I was thinking, interesting. Maybe that's because actually I have moved and I've adapted and I'm being a bit more present moment awareness, a bit more living in the moment and not overly focusing on the past so much. So actually I put it down as a good thing, because sometimes it's exhausting mentally to kind of factor all these things in. But I wanted to touch upon something we've kind of been talking about you said change the way you look at things and things you look at change. And one of the things that really reminds me of is a phenomenon in physics, specifically quantum physics, like the observer effect. I'm not sure how familiar you are with this, but basically the essence of it's really, really fascinating, right? What it's saying, and I'm gonna make it into an analogy that people will understand in a second. But what it's saying is that the fact that you look at an experiment changes the outcome of the experiment within quantum physics. So when you don't look at the experiment, the experiment behaves in a certain way. In this particular way, it looks like a wave pattern. But when you don't look at it, when you look at it, it becomes like a wave. When you don't look at it, it becomes like a particle. And the mere fact that you're looking at something changes the outcome. Now, I actually don't think that's very hard a concept to grasp. And the reason that I don't think it's hard, and as you're a football fan, right? If you were playing a football game because there was lots of violence and things in the previous leg of a Champions League, and you play it behind closed doors, so there's no crowd watching, I think we inherently know that that football game is going to end slightly differently than if the crowd is watching, because the watching crowd is the 12th man is actually changing the outcome of the game. It's the same in quantum physics, right? The person looking at something changes the outcome of the thing you're looking at. And I've just started watching, it's a bit of a slow burn, but an Apple TV show called Constellation. And effectively, it goes through they have this weird experiment in space, and they're trying to do this quantum superpositioning, which is basically all states appear in all things appear in a multitude of states until the moment you look at it. So for example, if there's a chair in the corner that neither of us can see, we think it's there, but it's not really there apparently until we look at it, because it can exist in multiple different states until you actually look at it. It's this thing called, I don't know if you've heard of Schrodinger's cat. Have you heard of Schrodinger's cat? So for those listening, it's a kind of a thought experiment. You have a box with a vial of poison in, and it's going to go off at some undetermined time when the radioactive decay of this element goes, and it's going to kill a cat that is inside. Now, the box is completely sealed. There's no sound, there's soundproof, and there's no windows, anything like that. So you don't know whether the cat is alive or dead until you actually open the box to see whether the poison has been released or not. So at that moment in time, the cat is both alive and dead, right? That's the whole paradox of it all. And this is what quantum physics a lot of the time says, is that everything exists in a potentiality, in a sea of potentiality, until the moment you observe it. So where I'm going with all this is where you said change the way you look at things and the things you look at change. That is both a nice phrase to think of, but also it's reality, is that when you look at things, things change, right? You change the way you look at things, those things will change as well. We have so much power in things, and we don't really understand it, but the physics is showing how our spiritual guidance or our spiritual teachings, talking about things like the phrase you just mentioned, is actually a reality.
I think there's we could do a whole show just on the idea of what sight is, you know, the idea of insight being sight from the inside anyway, the way that we look at things. I mean, you could argue even in quantum physics that things change just because by looking at something anyway, we change the energy field around it. But there's so many things at play when we talk about sight, when we talk about wisdom. I just think it's a fascinating subject anyway. You know, just the way that a lot of people go back to one of my favorite quotes anyway, which is, you know, those look outward dream, those look inside awaken, or inside awaken. And I think a lot of it comes down to the language of that we give ourselves with the eyes that we have and the way that we see the world, but also the energy and the things that get impacted by the way that we look at the world as well. I mean, it's a whole different podcast, but I find the stuff you just talked about really fascinating. Schrodinger's cat is something I was familiar with.
I mean, I really do recommend, and I mentioned it to you a few weeks ago. I don't think you've watched it yet, but I do recommend watching What the Bleep Do We Know? What the Bleep Do We Know? It's an old documentary type movie, but I've watched it maybe 5 or 6 times. I love watching it again with new people, bringing them in, and it explains this concept plus a bunch of other concepts in a way better way than I've just explained it now. So I think some of our viewers would have already watched it, but What the Bleep Do We Know? It's probably now 18 years old, this documentary thing.
To lower the tone and bring us back to the 90s, I don't know if it was 90s or not, and it's still relevant today, I think. And if anyone parents listening to this, it's worth going back to. It did make me chuckle and it made my kids laugh. We went back to Howie Enfield, the day, you know, if you remember Kevin, who the day he turns into a teenager.
Yes, I remember that. And he transforms into a teenager.
Oh, it's brilliant. We found it on YouTube in the old grainy video kind of quality that we used to watch as kids that we thought was amazing at the time. And I showed my daughter, who's 14, this video, and my son, who's 10, was in absolute stitches. And it's honestly, it's so true. It's just, it's pure nostalgia. Go and check it out. It was absolutely brilliant. And it did make me laugh. And I realized, actually, you know, teenagers are teenagers in any generation, but it did make me laugh.
I actually was thinking about this the other day, because Harry Enfield was in a sitcom that I was watching. So my mom has got me into this sitcom that I've gone through both seasons in about a week. I'm not sure if you watched it. It's on BBC iPlayer, but it's one of the few things that I've watched where I'm belly out laughing. It's called Here We Go, or Here We Go, something like that. I'm in hysterics. It's a typical family. And I think the woman in it is the one from the IT Crowd.
Oh, okay. Well, I love the IT Crowd. One of the best comedies ever made, I think. Love
IT Crowd. Well, that woman, she's the mum in that. And then the other guy who plays her husband is hilarious. He's like a former Olympic archer, but his physical comedy is so funny. And it's one of the Here We Go. And I think I've just been laughing out loud watching that. And it's very rare for me to do that. Even when I watch things like Friends, where I love watching that and I just don't belly out laugh. But Harry Enfield was, I mean, who's the character? What's the name called? Oh, it's Harry Enfield. That's the actor.
Yeah, in Kathy Burke, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So Harry Enfield was in it. He was looking really old, actually. He plays the character in one of the episodes. And I was thinking about that sketch as well. And that sketch is hilarious, where he goes from 12 to 13.
And yeah, anyone listening, go and check it out. It's generally really, really good. But there's a coaching bit that links to it as well. And certainly if you're dealing with teenagers and we're dealing with nostalgia and all the things, we think, you know, we weren't that difficult, right? But I'm sure most of us were like that. That's why that comedy exists in the first place. But there's an idea here that a coaching idea that if we expect the storm to come and we know it's coming, then we can manage it and we can plan for it. And that's true in many circumstances, whether you go back to a point in time or not. And I think in the case of that we're going through at the minute, which is having a teenager, I'll be slightly careful in case she listens to it, she'll get angry. But the idea being that we can expect the storm to come, which allows us to manage and plan for it, which are the changes in behavior and in motivation, in whatever it might be that we give back. And think, okay, let's not take any of this personally. It's just, you know, there are distractions out there. It's not easy being a teenager. It's not easy actually being a child in the current world that we live in now with all the distractions we've got, to take it full circle. I thought that was quite interesting. So I've been trying to remind myself, as I do with my clients, if you expect the storms, if we can, you know, if we expect them, we can plan for them, and then we can accept them, and it gets easier to grow through rather than go through the problem. And I think
it is that planning and knowing ahead of time, be prepared, as they said in the scouts, which I was a scout leader for, and also when it comes to like teenagers, like your good experience. It is putting yourself into that mind of that teenager, which is why I think, like me, sometimes rereading my journals helps me get into that frame of mind of being a teenager. Of like, you don't know what you want to do when you're 16 years old, and you know all this pressure of doing the homework and being social, and maybe you think you're being left out, and all your friends are being invited somewhere. All of that stuff's written down in my book, right? All of these thoughts that I had, these feelings, and they're feelings that I get to pull from. I'm not attached to those feelings anymore, but it helps give me insight into what other people at that age are going through, because it's not a memory that is now 30 years old. It's a memory that is 3 feet away from me. So I think that might be useful as you go into this next 4, 5, 6 year period that you've got with the teenagers.
Well, I mean, I tried to use one of my favorite quotes I've said in this show many times before, which, you know, your day doesn't create your mood creates your day. And I think I've got a shut up, Dad.
Yeah, I try so many of these things with my, especially one of my nieces that listens to this, and she's a little bit headstrong and she hates all of my little life lessons, as it were. So it's like, well, You have to teach them it in a more subtle way, in a very much more subtle way, through like video games or sports or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, the kids will be the first to throw back at you. You get grumpy. You're this. You're there.
Well, actually, I was doing something a bit similar to you about you creating the day, because I was asking her to make her bed, and I was talking about making the bed and it like being an achievement. Yeah, and all this, but yeah, it's lost on them.
Well, often, you know, I'll say that to them and they'll say, well, you don't do it. It's like, well, yeah, well, often we teach the things we most need to learn. That doesn't mean you don't have to do it.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like I always say, my monkey see, monkey do. So you can never, ever expect a child to do something that you're not prepared to do or they haven't seen you do. So.
And they've seemed to have memories like elephants. They'll remind you of any small misdemeanor. But hey, that's the fun of parenting. I absolutely love it. And I'm sure many listen to this do as well. You need the yin and the yang in parenting. That's what makes the journey so exciting. And as it is, if we go back in time as well, right?
Well, I was going to say, I wonder if there's any parents out there going, well, if I went back in time, I definitely would have put that condom on. Or something like that. But I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure there are no parents out there doing that. But I think the whole concept of time and time travel, I'm fascinated with it because I've studied a lot of it. And I do feel like, yeah, it's an interesting and crazy concept, time and traveling through time and space.
I like the fun way you probably explain it better than me, because you're immersed in this world with your degrees and things. But the idea that if you're on a star in another galaxy and you're able to see us as another, you know, as a planet Mars, but what they see now is that is time travel. So if you look out now and look at the stars, what we're seeing, it's taken that amount of time to get to us. It's already in the past. I just think that's weird, right? So you can actually see we can go back in time if you were to observe this planet from another star, because you'd be viewing the past.
It's crazy. But then having said that, again, bring it back to an analogy that people can understand, right? And you like, I think you like hiking and things like that, but let's say we were hiking, right? And you were on the top of Snowdon and I'm on the top of the next highest peak along in Wales, and you call out to me, I'm going to hear your voice a few seconds later, like you, like telling me, because we're used to that, right? The way that sound travels across vast distances. But it's the same with light, right? Light has a speed limit. And so you're literally looking into the past. It's really amazing.
And then there's the other concept, which isn't about time travel, but the idea of infinity, right? So right now, somewhere another, it's more likely than less likely to be true, which is the idea that there's two people called Nick and Harry having a podcast talking about this subject somewhere else on another planet, another galaxy that exists, because it, with infinite possibilities, has to suggest that is actually something that's happening right now, and it's probably happened before. I mean, that's, again, it's just madness.
Well, that's it. I mean, this is what that show Constellation is kind of talking about, where they create this experiment in space, it becomes this superposition, and then when the astronaut comes back, she is like slipping in and out of these other possibilities. So she's able to see people in the room that aren't there, because in another reality they happen to be there, but they can't see her, but then sometimes they do. And they haven't explained it fully yet in the series, and it's a really, really slow burn. But effectively, that's what's happening, is that they're able to see the different eventualities of that particular moment in time, which is fascinating.
Well, here's a really easy show for you, conscious of time for our listeners as well. We're also on Apple TV. It's a bit of a plug for Apple TV. I don't know why. We watched Amazing Stories, which you can get on Apple TV. And the first story on Apple TV is about time travel. They're all individual stories. They last 45 minutes each. We watched it last night and it was really good, really good family thing to watch. And the guy goes back in time to a different time. I won't ruin what happens. It's not what you expect, but it's absolutely relevant to what we talked about today. You get to go back to a different time. You get to have a choice, and it's changing the future by going back. But it was a really good 45-minute individual story called Amazing Stories, Apple TV. Go check it out.
Yeah, I'll pop that on later. My mum's staying over and we'll have the big screen on, so it'll be something to watch together.
Well, Harry, I'm glad we've been a little bit more positive than the previous shows, where we've talked about loss and animals and parents and other things. Nothing like a bit of nostalgia to bring back the energy into the space. So thanks for joining me today. I'm away next week, so not the list that'll necessarily have an impact on listeners. We'll never miss an episode getting published, but I look forward to seeing you when I get back. Have a nice evening with your mum, and we'll catch up soon.
All right, and take care, listeners, and remember to follow along, subscribe to our YouTube channel, Mindful Paths Podcast, I believe it is, and our Instagram as well, at The Mindful Paths.
Or click on the show notes of this episode. All the links are in the show notes. That's probably the easiest way to go.